Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. My name is Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. Our guest today is mastering engineer David Glasser of Airshow Mastering. But first of all, let's talk about four Facebook rules to keep you out of trouble with your fans. And hopefully you have a lot of fans and a lot of followers on Facebook. Everybody wants more, and everybody wants to engage the fans they have and keep them happy and keep them coming back. But there are a number of things that you shouldn't do because basically it antagonizes your fans and it leads to fan attrition, follower attrition. The first thing is don't like your own post. This is pretty ego-driven. If you can't get other people to like your posts, then you doing it isn't going to really help the cause. So this is bad form. Don't do it. The second thing is don't post or tag photos of people without their permission. Usually, people like this. They like to have their photos taken. The only problem is sometimes there are people that are trying to be discreet. And those are the ones that aren't really happy when all of a sudden they show up on Facebook when they should have been somewhere else. So be safe about it. Ask their permission. And really, the best thing is to get it in writing. It's not always possible, but that's the safest way. But just play it safe and ask people before you post pictures of them. The third thing is don't tag people or pages that aren't relevant to you. And this is a pet peeve of mine. I hate when people do that to me. So basically, there's a photo that shows up that I'm tagged in, but I'm not in at all. And it's just an enticement to get me to look at it or get me to go to a page. Believe me, I don't like that at all, and neither does anybody else. So don't do it. The fourth thing is don't ask for likes or comments. And this is something that everybody does, at least occasionally, and you really shouldn't. The biggest reason why, it's against the Facebook terms of use, which I know you didn't read when you signed up for it, signed up to be on Facebook, but they told you up front, and they've actually been getting more stringent about it in recent years, you can't ask for a like or a comment. And you used to be able to actually use a third party to be able to do this kind of legally. Woobox was one, woobox.com. There was something called a like gate that you could use. So basically, it was a way of saying, okay, if you like this particular page or photo or post or whatever, then you get something for free. You get a download or whatever. And Facebook now frowns on that. They won't let you do it. So don't ask for likes or comments. At least don't do it regularly. Occasionally you can get away with it just asking for a comment. A way to get a comment that's a lot better is to ask a question, something like, what do you think about this? And that's a much better way to actually get comments than to say, will you comment on this? So those are four simple rules that will keep you out of trouble on Facebook with your fans and with Facebook as well. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyointercircle.com. I really like to hear what you think about everything, and I like your suggestions. So questions@bobbyointercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program, 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio, and you can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is something that's really interesting, at least on some level. There was a recent crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo in an effort to buy out Gibson guitars. Now, why? Well, Gibson has been changing lately. It's becoming a lifestyle company. What you'll see from it, like for instance at the last NAMM show, are a lot of products that aren't really musical in nature, headphones, radios, things like that. And they're trying to expand. Kind of understandable they're trying to do that, to go wide. On the other hand, there's a lot of people who feel that they're losing their way by ignoring the guitar business. And a guy named John L. wanted to raise $22 million in order to buy Gibson. He started this Indiegogo campaign, and he only got $200 before he was shut down as a scam. So why was this a scam? He basically has come on and said, no, 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 I was really trying to do this. But on the other hand, everybody says, well, wait a second, you have no management team and you really didn't give a roadmap of the future. And how do you know if you raised $22 million that you can actually even buy it? because Gibson isn't for sale. And how do you know that it's $22 million and they don't want more? So this was kind of a ridiculous crowdfunding campaign. It just goes to show you, though, that people will try to crowdfund just about anything. Music is very successful, actually, any kind of music campaign. About 50% of music campaigns or music-related campaigns get funded, and sometimes it's a little higher, which is quite a lot. That being said, there's kind of a secret to it, and that you already need followers, you already need fans in order to make this happen. And one of the big problems that people have is they don't have fans. For instance, a band that wants to fund an album, well, if you don't have fans that know about you to begin with, you probably aren't going to get any new ones via this campaign unless you're very, very, very clever. So it doesn't always work, as you can see. My guest today is David Glasser, who is one of the founders of Airshow Mastering. His clients have been nominated for 80 Grammy Awards, and David has won two himself. He's worked on a number of prestigious projects like the Grateful Dead catalog and the Anthology of American Folk Music. David is also one of the few mastering engineers to work in DSD, thanks to his very, very deep experience with the SACD format. I spoke with David via Skype from a studio in Boulder, Colorado. David, thanks so much for being on my podcast. This is great of you. I'm so happy that you're here.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
If you were to say that Airshow Mastering had a specialty, what would it be?
You know, there was never any master plan. Everything just sort of happened as it happened, like most fortuitous things. If you have a specialty, it's probably our eclecticism, I think. Because we do all kinds of stuff, and I've always liked working at the margins of what I'm comfortable with. That's how we got into surround. That's how we jumped into SACD, and that's how, I guess, we originally jumped into spending a boatload of money on one of the first no-noise systems, and that kind of led us to a lot of the restoration work that I guess we've sort of become known for.
Yeah, you know, when I think of Airshow, I think of a specialty in acoustic music, especially folk music, things like that, because you've done an awful lot of that type of music, and I think, you know, that's where you guys excel.
Well, you know, yeah, that's definitely true. But I hate to be pigeonholed, because we have, an engineer, at our studio in Boulder, Dominic Maeda, who does all the music for Glee. You know, when people say, oh, folk acoustic music, you know, you kind of forget that other stuff. And, you know, all the, kind of jam bandy things that I've been doing lately, you know, that that's, I guess, a type of folk music, but it's not what, you know, most people think of as folk music.
That's true. That's true. But, you know, again, it's not mainstream so much, but that's okay, right? Because, you know, what you do is so cool and you're so good at it. I really enjoy your newsletter, because every time I get one, there's something, a new Grammy that you guys either received, or you work with somebody that got a Grammy, or lots of them actually, or some very new projects. The Grateful Dead catalog, redoing that was awesome.
Yes, boy, that was a dream come true, and I was so nervous about that. You know, that's like restoring the Sistine Chapel. You know, that was what was on my mind, you know, when I was working on it, you really don't want to screw this up.
Well, was there anything different about that from many of the other projects you've done?
Well, in a way, you know, everything that we do is the same. You make something sound the way you think the producer wanted it to sound in their mind's ear. And the interesting thing about that project, which was all 13 of the Grateful Dead studio albums, was we used Plangent processing on 12 of the records, and the 13th was a digital project, so it didn't apply. But I think made a quantum leap in what we were able to extract from those tapes.
Yeah, explain what that is.
It's a process developed by Jamie Howarth in Massachusetts for removing Wow and Flutter and all the sonic problems that those create from an analog tape recording. And he does it in a really interesting way, and we're set up to do transfers for that process by identifying and extracting the latent bias signal on the tape. And that could be a very, very stable, high-frequency signal, anywhere from 80 kilohertz for one of the early tape machines up to 250 kilohertz for the most recent Studer machines. ATRs are around 450 kilohertz, and that's impossible to extract. But anyway, by using that signal as a reference, he can speed correct for any speed problems, and it also removes all the FM distortion that those speed perturbations create. So really strips away a bunch of layers of the onion, if you will. Bob Ludwig used it for the Bruce Springsteen catalog with really great success. And I wish more reissue producers would take advantage of that.
Is it expensive?
Yeah, it adds cost to the process. Most people will say, well, these tapes sound fantastic as they are. Why should I spend an additional $2,000 to make something that already sounds great? I'm just throwing money away. But, you know, if you think of these recordings as valuable treasures, you know, we kind of owe it to the music to do that. So it does cost extra, but these recordings are not going to last forever. And once you hear the before and after difference, it's pretty remarkable.
You know, you mentioned before about no noise. How often do you use that? Is that still something that's viable? Because I know for a long time, a no-noise system was really important to have, and it was used all the time. But I hear less and less about it. So do you still use yours?
Well, there's all... By no-noise, that's the sonic system. And yeah, we do use that. Not very often for the broadband noise reduction, but for distortion removal, click removal, that kind of stuff, we use it all the time. And then now, of course, there's Isotope and spectral editing, and those things are really indispensable.
I want to talk about Airshow for a second. You have two locations, which is kind of interesting. So you have Boulder, where you're at,
mm-hmm.
right? And then you have Tacoma. How did that come about, where you having two different locations?
Well, I started the company in Virginia. I opened the first studio in Springfield, Virginia. My partner there, Charlie Pilzer, took over the studio in Virginia when I made a move out to Colorado, because we realized that we don't have to shut this down. This is a viable thing. So Charlie took over the East Coast studio while I built the facility in Boulder. And in the last 5 years or so, he moved from Virginia to Maryland, Tacoma Park, Maryland, and built a larger studio there. We're all part of the same same company.
Got it. You also, you're interesting in that you also have mixing facilities.
Yes.
And usually mastering house just is mastering and doesn't have anything else. So how does that work?
You know, for the longest time, I didn't want to get into that. And I'm not a mixer, but I didn't want the company to get into mixing or recording because I didn't want to compete with my clients who were producers and engineers and studios. But after every studio and every engineer started offering mastering services, I figured, you know, there's probably some work there. So we started slowly by turning one of our smaller rooms into a mix room, and more recently Charlie Pilzer, when he built the new facility in Maryland, built a full tracking room with a really, really nice control room. I got to say that the income from recording and mixing is not as lucrative as the mastering part, but it's something that I think has helped us because now for a lot of clients we can be a one stop shop, and for now that's working. I kind of go back and forth as to how great an idea it really was.
But you're right, though. I understand about competing with your clients, but when they're competing with you, it's kind of a different story, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. So you started at NPR.
Yeah, yes. Well, actually, before NPR, I was working for a company that did the syndication of the Boston Symphony and Boston Pops orchestra recordings in the days before the internet, before satellite, when my first job there was running the tape duplicators, and every 2 weeks we would send out two shows on open reel tape to several hundred stations. So that was my start in the business. And after a while of just doing the tape duplication, I started helping out on the recordings at Symphony Hall, and that was something that I'll never forget, and I'm always grateful for having the opportunity to work in that great hall.
Oh, no kidding! That's awesome.
Yeah,
but see, that's what sets you apart from a lot of mastering engineers that I know. You have the hands-on experience, and especially with that type of music, you know what it sounds like for real, you know, right there. So it's so much easier than when you come back on the other side and you begin to listen to a playback of something. You know what it's supposed to sound like.
Boy, you know, everybody should try and do that. Even if you're working in R&B or rock and roll or whatever, everybody should have the experience of seeing a great orchestra in a great concert hall. It just really opens your ears up.
Yeah, it's sort of the same thing out in Hollywood here when there used to be a lot of orchestras playing scores for movies. Mm-hmm. And you'd go into the studio and you'd hear 120 pieces in the studio in a big soundstage, and there's nothing like it. I mean, you know,
exactly.
you hear the downbeat, you go, oh my God, I've never heard anything like this. And even though you may be familiar with what an orchestra sounds like, just being in that environment and listening to it is just incredible, especially when you're close up.
Yes. When I was a freshman in college, I went with a friend of mine to Symphony Hall. The only tickets that we could afford were in the very, very back row, up against the back wall, and it was Leonard Bernstein conducting the Boston Symphony Orchestra doing Beethoven's Ninth.
Wow.
And you could feel the bass just pounding your chest. And I'll never forget that sensation.
Yeah, and it's funny, we try to recreate that ever since, right? You know, in a studio, you try to get that. And it's, I don't know about you, but it's, you know, like the perfect wave, still trying to find it.
It's pretty elusive, and when you come across a recording that does capture that, it's wow. That's really something.
Your signal chain is analog and digital, right? Or you're more of an analog guy?
Mostly analog, but I can accommodate any workflow, all digital, all analog, DSD included, practically any source format.
So you're playing back on what kind of platform then?
Well, most of the projects come in as digital files, and my main workstation is SoundBlade from Sonic Studio.
Mm-hmm. So you're coming out of that, and then you're going through an analog signal chain?
Most of the time, yeah.
And then are you recording back into SoundBlade or into another platform?
Mostly back into SoundBlade, occasionally into another platform if we need to capture at a different sample rate.
And are you getting much in at a high resolution, like 9624 or even higher? Are you getting much of that?
Let's see. I'd say it's about half and half between single speed and double speed, either 88 or 96. And all the work we've been doing for the Grateful Dead, they've requested 192 masters. So a lot of my work recently has been at 192.
I've done the tests. And this is quite a few years ago, even, where we recorded the same thing at 48K, 96K, and 192. And 192 was so much better. I couldn't believe it. 96K was a little better than 48K, but 192 was like the old, is it live or is it Memrex?
Yeah, great.
So, well, that's cool that you're doing that. I'm always surprised when I get mixing projects in that are at 44.1 still, you know? I go, man, you guys didn't get the message yet. But there's still people doing that. Tell me about vinyl. You doing a lot of vinyl?
Well, we don't have a lathe, so I'm not cutting vinyl. But, a lot of the stuff ends up on vinyl. Most of the time, we're supplying masters that are at a higher resolution than the CD version, usually with less or no peak limiting, and let the lacquer cutter decide what to do with it. If they're pressed well, these vinyl records can sound pretty good.
Yeah, that's for sure. I just posted on my blog today about how there were 13 lathes found abandoned in a warehouse in Chicago. And it was one of those things, well, they haven't been making them in 35 years.
Yeah.
And to find new ones that are available is a really good thing because, you know, most every pressing plant is pretty much up against the wall in terms of, you know, what they can deliver. I think everybody's out, you know, a month or two.
A lot of the lead times that we've been hearing are 3 and 4 months.
Wow. Amazing, huh? Who would have thought it would come back like that? Did you ever think about putting a lathe in?
I did for a while, and I talked to Chris Muth about what it would take, and he didn't intend to, but essentially he talked me out of it because I kind of got from that conversation that it would take a couple years of and many hundreds of blown lacquers to figure out what the hell we were doing. I decided to let somebody else handle that end of it. We would stick with what we were good at.
Yeah, it's really an art, that's for sure. I think you kind of have to grow up with it. And you know, it's funny because all the guys I talk to that do cut lacquers, they started really early and they always had a really good mentor.
Sure.
So to jump in by yourself, I guess it would probably cost a lot of dough, just as you say, in blown lacquers.
Mm-hmm.
And cutter heads.
Yes.
Even more expensive. So, okay, so you've been doing DSD for a long time, and SACDs.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, you know, you don't think of, and I think you are way ahead of everybody doing that, as a matter of fact, and you don't think of a facility in Boulder being in the forefront somehow of the audio technology. You'd kind of think it would happen in New York or L.A. or wherever. So how did that happen?
Well, Gus Guinness, who spearheaded the Sony SACD initiative, was located in Boulder. So that was the connection. And for the early years, the first couple years of SACD, he was using our studio to try things out and to do transfers and mastering and so forth. So that was the connection. And of course, nobody's making SACDs anymore, but we'll occasionally get mixes in on DSD and occasionally send DSD masters out for those couple websites that sell DSD files.
Yeah, I know there's a fair amount of them, actually. There's five or six that I saw that were doing DSD.
Oh, I didn't realize there were that many. Yeah.
And I always wonder, it's like, are these brand new files, or are they brand new projects, or are they just projects that are left over from the SACD days or not?
I think it's a combination of that.
So
it is, and I think it will remain very much a small niche, but it's kind of interesting.
That's for sure. So how often do you get a DSD file in?
Oh, maybe 3% of the time, not very often.
Okay, it's still more often than most places,
yeah.
Though,
yeah.
That's for sure. And how about surround? You doing a lot of surround projects?
Boy, not as many as I'd like to. We're all set up for it. I think the last surround thing I did was a couple months ago. Maybe do 5 or 6 a year if we're lucky. You used to do a lot of that too. How many are you doing these days?
I haven't done one in years. And, you know, it's funny, I'm great pals with the Oasis Mastering over here, and I used to have an office there, and it was the same thing. There was a studio all set up for it, and they eventually took it down because there was just, you know, once a year, you know, someone would come in and we'd run over, we'd set it up for that one time during the year and pull it down at the end. But, you know, I think it's a wonderful format, but it never caught on consumer level.
Yeah.
And the real reason, again, is, you know, it's the old thing. It's the wife syndrome, where there's too many speakers, too many wires, and the surround speakers are always haphazardly placed, so you can't really hear, you know, it at its peak. So there was a lot of that, you know, that was really going against it that none of us anticipated, I guess.
Yeah, it's too bad, because I just love doing those projects. And most of them, actually all of them in the last 5 years at least, have been video projects for DVD and occasional theatrical release, mostly concert-type films.
Right. One of the things that, well, there's two things I should say, that Airshow is way ahead of everybody else and is really a great example for people in the industry, for facilities in the industry, for anybody in the industry. And one is your website, and two is your newsletter, I have to say.
Well, thank you.
The website is wonderful. There's not a lot of whistles and bells, but it's everything you need to know and more without feeling cluttered. It feels very clean. It's just great. And it's the same thing with the newsletter. I look forward to it. You send it out every couple months, I guess, right?
We try and do it, actually, based on what you've been preaching. We've been trying to keep to a schedule. We're not always successful, but we've been trying for every month. And most of the time, we make it.
Yeah, and it's great. I I have to say, I read it every time, but it's easy to read. That's another thing. It's very easy to go through, even at a glance, and grasp all the information, but I enjoy reading it because it does keep me up on what you're doing. And I'll look at something and go, oh, David did that. Oh, that's cool. And even though we may not speak for, I guess, you know, between something like this or when we run into each other at a trade show, at least I'll know what's happening with you. And mm-hmm. that's very cool. And it has to help business. I'm sure it does.
You know, it does. We always get a spike in at least communication with long-lost clients when we send these things out. So I know that it's helping. And it always seems like it's a lot of work to pull together, but I guess ultimately it's worth it because people seem to like it, and I have to like it before it goes out, and I'm a real harsh critic.
Well, you have good taste because it does the job, and again, it's a great example. I use your newsletters when I give lectures on social media. I use them as an example, basically saying this is a great way to do it. So I for what that's worth, I think they're great. I think they're very cool.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that.
One last thing here. Tell me more about restoration. I know you've done a lot of things for Smithsonian and a lot of universities.
Mm-hmm.
Is that all word of mouth?
Well, we set something up that we called the Restoration Center that is not really a mastering service, but it's more in the archivist librarian realm. And we've reached out to universities and libraries and collectors to transfer and preserve important collections. So that's kind of separate from the commercial restoration work that we do, but it's really interesting. We've done a bunch of stuff for Naropa, including tons of Allen Ginsberg lectures and poetry readings. We did some Navajo Nation recordings. We're talking to some people in Fiji at the moment for a big collection. So that's really interesting, and they're usually big projects, so they keep a couple people busy for an extended time. And then there's the commercial projects like the Anthology of American Folk Music, which won a Grammy, and the Charlie Patton, likewise. And the past couple of years, the Rise and Fall of Paramount Records that Jack White put out.
Wow.
And that was pretty awesome.
When you say big project, what does that mean?
Several hundred hours of tapes or discs to transfer.
Yeah, that's a lot, that's for sure. So do you have to, is this kind of like assembly line stuff that once you get the first one, you can just put the other ones through, or do you have to, is each one unique?
Yeah, I'm kind of a believer in that you can't just push the button and let it run. You really do need to pay attention. Which means calibrating the tape machines for each tape and making sure that that's all correct and the levels are all correct and that any problems are noted and fixed if possible. So there are places that do a lot of the stuff unmonitored, but we try not to do that.
Last question.
So we lose out on a lot of projects, but you know that's okay. I would rather do them correctly.
Yeah. Last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you ever either learned or received from someone? Music business advice.
Well, I don't know if I could recall any specific advice, but my experience working with various people, and I've been lucky to work with some really smart people. One is never say no, and always push yourself. If you think that you could do it, then you'll find a way to do it. And don't be afraid to step in the deep end once in a while.
Very good advice, and really, it's good for everybody. And a recurring theme that I hear, where you know, again, don't say no, and don't be afraid to push yourself. It seems to be recurrent in the music business that if you're going to make anything work, that's what you have to do.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
David, thanks so much for being with me today. This is Dynamite. I enjoyed.
Hey, Bobby, thank you.
I enjoyed the talk as always. To find out more about David, go to airshowmastering.com. That's airshowmastering, all one word, .com. David is also featured in the third edition of my Mastering Engineer's Handbook. Very nice interview there, as he just did here on the podcast. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyointercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com, and he helps put this webcast together. Thank you very much, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyointercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher at bobbyosinski.com or bobbyointercircle.com to find the sign-up form for my newsletter for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time